Qaeda was killed near Jabalia al-Nazla, and 5 Palestinians were killed in an assassination operation the Israeli occupation army carried out on the western parts of Gaza City. And that was the target of that attack was the commander Ra'ed Saad, who was killed as a result of this attack. This actually highlights how the Israeli occupation army is still and is ongoing in its assassinations, is still actually searching and looking for catches here and there around the Gaza Strip in order to carry out more assassinations and in order to continue in these one-sided violations of the ceasefire agreement.
The World Health Organization now has issued a stark warning about the situation of the health sector in Gaza. And according to the World Body, 18 out of 36 hospitals and 43% of all primary health centers are only partially functioning. According to the WHO, there are no MRI machines left and only 2 CT scanners there to cover a population of over 2 million. It added there is a severe shortage of essential medicine and medical supplies needed to treat diseases, especially heart and kidney disease, as well as intensive care surgery. The organization said it's facing challenges for bringing laboratory material and critical lab machinery into Gaza because Israeli forces are preventing the entry of items by classifying them as dual use. WHO said that Gaza's humanitarian crisis is worsening amid severe flooding and storms. Thousands of civilians are sheltering in coastal areas with no drainage or protective barriers. Political analyst Robert Inlakesh joined us earlier. He said, backed by the U.S., Israel is pursuing a plan for a new Gaza, which includes forced displacement and long-term ethnic cleansing.
What we're seeing right now is that still essential items are restricted. There's flooding that, of course, has just affected over 100,000 tents in the Gaza Strip this past week. Of course, people are dying from all sorts of different ailments. Many are injured and are prevented from leaving or getting the right medical attention. This is all, of course, by design. The Israelis want this chaos. They want this to happen. They're openly looking at a scheme alongside the United States and monitored by the so-called Civil Military Coordination Center to invent what they call a new Gaza. And so the new Gaza will be the territory that where those remaining will be forced to flee to, and the rest then perhaps can be slowly ethnically cleansed. This is one of the potential outcomes that the Israelis are looking for. They don't want for things to go back to normal in Gaza, and they're not going to allow that to happen. And we can see that if they wanted to allow the aid in, they would. Now, the only difference is, during this pause, is that at CMCC, which is composed of 20 countries and over 40 different international organizations, is overseeing everything the Israelis do on a daily basis, including killing civilians, including demolishing buildings, including preventing the aid. It's all well documented. So this CMCC is complicit in the genocide.
Thousands of demonstrators take to the streets to occupy territories, holding another weekly rally to slam the Israeli Prime Minister's handling of the Gaza war. They're also demanding Benjamin Netanyahu be held accountable for the regime's security failures of October 7, 2023. Now, protesters and Netanyahu continues to blame everyone for what happened back in October of 2023, but is not willing to take any accountability himself. They also call for a professional commission of inquiry headed by a judge to probe the regime's failures. They slammed Netanyahu's attempt to choose the members of the commission himself, saying it will give him an unfair advantage and prevent true accountability. They carried signs reading the rule of law, not the rule of Netanyahu, urging the regime's president to refuse to pardon the prime minister. Organizers pledged to keep up their anti-Netanyahu rallies until remains of the last Israeli captive returned from Gaza. The UN says Israeli forces have forcibly displaced more than 1,000 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of the year. According to a UN deputy spokesperson, Farhan Haq, most of the displaced occurred around Area C, which comprises approximately 60% of the West Bank and is under full Israeli control. He added, displacement came after a majority of Palestinian homes were labeled as unauthorized over alleged lack of building permits and demolished. The Palestinian residents argue those construction permits are virtually impossible to get granted and rarely granted by the regime's officials. He His remarks come after the UN reported a rise in Israeli military and settler violence across the West Bank. Regime forces killed a Palestinian child Saturday in the town of Silat al-Harithia, west of Jenin. According to local sources, Israeli forces fatally shot 16-year-old before taking his body. And for your West Bank update, we're there joined by Ramallah correspondent Naka Ahmed.
In 2024, 3,070 Palestinians have also been forcibly displaced from Area C. Most of them are from Bedouin clusters and Bedouin communities all over the occupied West Bank. And this is according to humanitarian development statement number 201 by the UN itself, which stated that the Israeli forces and the Israeli regime are pushing Palestinians very hard to leave the places that they have inhabited for tens of years. And another 1,500 Palestinians are under the dire threat of being forcibly displaced. So 2025 was not much of a change than 2024. And this is something that, unfortunately, as many analysts are seeing, 2026 may have also worse numbers, as of course the Israeli regime is announcing plans and budgets that are directed towards settlement expansion and towards expelling Palestinians out of the occupied territories in the West Bank, especially Area C, which is considered to be the most strategic areas. Most of the water fountains and the water sources are in Area C. Most of the agricultural areas are in Area C. Most of the industrial zones are also in Area C.
To London now, where British protesters once again gather outside UK Parliament to condemn the Gaza genocide. Demonstrators say exposing crimes committed by Israel in the Holy Land are especially relevant this time of year as the world is getting ready to celebrate the birth of Jesus Christ.
In the midst of the Israeli regime's ongoing genocide in Gaza, a number of protesters have gathered outside the British Parliament to hold a special Christmas service in honour of all those killed in the Holy Land of Palestine. This vigil seeks to combine prayers for the people of Palestine with outrage at the British government's role in supporting the Israeli regime's genocide against those Palestinians. And attendees particularly want to draw attention to the treatment meted out to both Muslims and Christians by the Jewish extremists inside the Netanyahu administration. The protesters say that Western media and political elites deliberately obfuscate the existence of Palestinian Christians to make it easier to demonize the victims of Israel's genocide and label them as terrorists not worthy of being humanized.
There's been a lot of work done to basically depict Muslims as terrorists. No one talks about Christian terrorists or Jewish terrorists. When they think of that word, they automatically think Muslim. So that's why that framing exists right now. But we know Christians live in Palestine. We've had vicars talk about how their churches are being bombed. We know Israel attacks them.
Members of different religious communities were in attendance to commemorate the victims of the genocide. Jewish pro-Palestinian groups concede that politicians like Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir have deep support amongst the Jewish settlers occupying Palestine, with churches and mosques being destroyed by the Zionist Israeli regime in the birthplace of Jesus, and hundreds of thousands of people murdered. It will take serious work to break through the pro-Israel propaganda and make wider Christian populations understand what's taking place in Palestine to those they claim are their brethren. Issa Kadhimi, London.
Iran's foreign minister has told a meeting of special representatives of Afghanistan's neighbors the common future of the region is tied to the future of the South Asian country.
The experience of the past few decades has clearly shown that the security, development, and welfare of Afghanistan are directly tied to the interests of its neighboring countries.
I'd actually call for joint measures against existing challenges and crises, saying they must be addressed through dialogue and active regional participation. He said greater cooperation upgrades common security and stability and limits foreign interference. Al-Ashi noted NATO's military intervention in Afghanistan clearly showed how policies imposed from outside have failed to bring stability and sustainable development to the region. He further called for integration of Afghanistan in regional political and economic processes that help shore up regional security. Now, Tehran is hosting a meeting of Afghanistan's neighbors where representatives from Pakistan, Russia, and China, among others, are present. Now, Iran says the U.S. should be held accountable for its interference in other countries as Washington's meddlesome policies have brought crimes to the region of West Asia. Foreign Ministry spokesman Ismail Baghaei said such U.S. policies led to the loss of millions of lives in the region. The recent acknowledgement by U.S. Special Envoy to the region proves Washington's policies have failed. Baghaei made the remarks during a weekly presser in Tehran. In Venezuela, people have taken to the streets of a state of Miranda to protest a recent seizure of Venezuelan oil tanker by the United States military.
Today, the people of Miranda show through their mobilization all their condemnation and rejection of the piracy of the North American government, which seeks to seize Venezuelan oil and has repeatedly used tricks to undermine the peace of the Venezuelan people. This is how the people of Miranda rise up against piracy.
Waving Venezuelan flag, demonstrators condemned the U.S. seizure of the oil tanker as piracy. They also declared their commitment to defending their homeland and independence. A protester said seizure of the tanker reveals the U.S.'s true intention towards Venezuela. On Wednesday, the U.S. seized an oil tanker off the coast of Venezuela in an operation that Washington justified over sanctions. It is all part of a pressure campaign U.S. has launched against the South American country since September. It's deployed over 15,000 troops, warships, and fighter jets to the Caribbean under the pretext of fighting drug trade. Venezuela, however, says the military buildup is strictly aimed at toppling the Venezuelan government and to gain control of the country's oil resources. At least two students are killed after a gunman opens fire at Brown University in the U.S. state of Rhode Island.
Our focus right now is on supporting the families who have been affected by this, the families of the two students who sadly lost their lives today, as well as the eight, now nine, students who are in the hospital. We've been in touch with their families. I will talk to them soon. But, you know, we will come together as a community and we'll get through this.
Nine people were also injured. Officials say six victims are in critical but stable condition, while one is in critical condition. Now, police released surveillance footage showing a man you saw earlier believed to be the suspect. Shooter remains at large and residents have been urged to stay indoors. And more than 400 law enforcement officers are involved in the search. An incident comes amid a surge in gun violence, with more than 70 school shootings reported in America so far this year. Protesters in Washington, D.C. paraded around the White House with what they call the People's Indictment. More than a year after Trump was reelected, demonstrations continued to take place nationwide with no signs of stopping. Ramin Mazahiri reports.
Coordinated protests against the administration of Donald Trump continue, with activists surrounding the White House to deliver a people's indictment against Trump. From the deployment of National Guard troops in American cities to unprecedented illegal immigration raids to the axing of federal funding of government departments, Trump has inspired some activists to remain in a mode of permanent protest.
I'm 76 years old. Okay, I was able to live in the Vietnam era where Nixon had to leave office. Okay, other countries through mass protests like South Korea, other countries have like massively stood up in nonviolent, very compelling actions to really inspire people and disrupt the workings of what's going on nonviolently. And we can do that.
The protesters say their regular actions are to inspire millions of Americans to return to the nation's capital and nonviolently oust an administration they accuse of being fascist. Economic issues continue to mount in the United States, both structural, like inflation, housing, and healthcare costs, and new, like a Wall Street bust in the artificial intelligence boom. Just 31% approve of Trump's handling of the economy, which is his all-time low and down from 40% as recently as March. Trump's MAGA, or Make America Great Again, base is also showing signs of fracture due to his imperialist attacks on Iran, Gaza, and Venezuela, which contradict his promises to end Washington's foreign meddling and endless wars. Trump's overall approval rating is 36%, which is down from 42% earlier this year, but which is still rather high for a Western head of state. However, his right-wing economic policies target the upper and not the working class, and he appears to be exacerbating rather than healing America's many cultural divides. Ramin Mazahiri, Washington, D.C.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of the program. Today is special.
Can't you see this wonder spread in front of you? The clouds floating by, the sky so clear and blue. Planets in their orbits, the moon and the sun. Such perfect harmony. Let's start questioning ourselves. Isn't this proof enough for us?
Today is Sunday, is the 23rd of Jamadi al-Thani 1447 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 23rd of Azar 1404 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 14th of December 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. Let's bless our day with the recitation of the Holy Quran by listening to the Arabic text of the Holy Quran and the English translation. Today, Brother Mahmoud, the producer, selected Surah Maryam, ayahs 31 and 32 for you. Let's listen to the Holy Quran, start a program with the recitation of the Holy Quran. We'll be back in a minute.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. وجعلني مباركا أينما كنت وأوصاني بالصلاة والزكاة ما دمت حيا.
And he has made me blessed wherever I am, and has enjoined upon me prayer and zakah as long as I remain alive.
وبرا بوالدتي ولم يجعلني جبارا شقيا.
And made me dutiful to my mother, and he has not made me a wretched tyrant.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
All right. Welcome back. You're listening to today's special with me, Atta, the host of this program. By mentioning the word mother, Prophet Jesus Christ, Isa al-Masih, has pointed to the chastity of his mother, that is Maryam, and his lack of father. Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam, in a beautiful hadith, states, the best deeds are prayer in time, that is salat on time, kindness to parents, respecting the parents, and holy struggle in the way of Allah, that is jihad in the way of Allah. Okay, you might say, what is jihad? Jihad is not war. If you do your action as a parent in a good way, it is a jihad. It is a struggle life. As a teacher, it is a jihad. As a former, it is a jihad. You are working in the media for producing Islamic content, it is a jihad. So, holy struggle is not holy war, okay? The Messenger of Allah, peace be upon him, stated, one who obeys the command of Allah regarding parents, two doors of the paradise will be open for him. And if he obeys the command of Allah regarding one of them, then one door will be open to him. That's it. Inshallah, the doors of heaven are open to every committed Muslim. Let's take a break and then we'll get to a beautiful, interesting topic.
Every morning I wake up and see the splendor of Allah's beauty. The sky at dawn, the silent trees, praise be
to him supreme is he. Praise be to him supreme is he. As I set to start my day, I think of Allah and I pray. His blessings are with me always. Praise be to him, most kind is he. Praise be to him, most kind is he.
Welcome back, dear listeners of iRab English Radio. Thanks for joining us on today's special on iRab English Radio. Okay. Motherhood more than a job. All right. Motherhood. It's a job which is not paid enough. We cannot do justice by words to tell the mother, okay, you do sacrifice every day, 24 hours on call without being paid. The heaven is under the feet of the mothers. The British author George Orwell once says, we have now sunk to depths at which the restatement of the obvious is the first duty of intelligent men. As true as this may have been during Orwell's lifetime, he died in 1950, it seems even more so in our contemporary discussions about the importance of motherhood. You know that George Orwell is the author of two important novels, 1984, number one, and Animal Farm. Why is it that our societies, Western societies in particular, and many Eastern ones as well, have failed in the last several decades to recognize the obvious importance of the roles of mothers? Why is it so? I think because the foundation of the family and the role of the mothers were changed. Okay, so let's go and see what the text say. Why do so many mothers struggle with the need to feel accomplished in other areas of life as they raise their young children? An act that, if done correctly, is undoubtedly one of the most significant accomplishments anyone could ever achieve. So, the mother is not accomplishing this task in the house as a wife and the mother, so when I go outside, work in a workplace, you know, being paid, getting salary and payment and wages, and then tell herself, I am enough now. This is what the psychology and the secular one tells the women to do. Islamic way is completely different.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dear and sisters, assalamu alaikum and welcome to another edition from series of today's special from Arab English Radio. This is Ali, your host, with another topic to discuss with you on motherhood. The foundation of the family is laid with the decision to marry, and the importance of the mother is evident in Islamic teachings, beginning with marriage and then child rearing. The first is the emphasis on choosing a good wife. Islam advocates choosing of a wife based on moral characteristics. The Holy Prophet ﷺ says, marrying to decent family, for genes have effects. He is also reported to have encouraged Muslims to marry virtuous women in order to have virtuous children. He has condemned those who look only for wealth or beauty when choosing a spouse. The Quranic verses which talk about the rights of parents include the mother. However, the Holy Prophet ﷺ has enjoined goodness to the mother even before the father. A man once came for advice to him as to who he should be good to. The Prophet ﷺ advised him to do good to his mother again. Three times the man asked, and three times the Prophet ﷺ told him to do good to his mother. At the fourth time, the Prophet ﷺ told him to do good to his father. This well-known story clearly illustrates the position of the mother in Islam. IRIB English Radio. Recitation as well as translation of Quran.
وَلَقَدْ آتَيْنَا مُوسَى الْكِتَابَ لَعَلَّهُمْ يَهْتَدُونَ.
And we certainly gave Moses the scripture, that perhaps they would be guided.
Short commentary of the Quran.
La ilaha illallah.
Islamic issues.
Institutional family in Islam is the most beloved by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
The life of the infallible. All in all, in today's special, IRIB English Radio.
Qualities of a mother. Sacrifice and dedication. A mother gives up a great deal for the sake of the child. She gives up her time, her sleep, her pleasure, etc. to ensure that the child is still right. As Imam Zain al-Abidin says in his book, Risalatul Huquq, or the Treatise of Rights, nobody comes even close to doing what a mother does for her child. That is why he says that it is only with the help of the Almighty Allah that one can thank the mother for all her sacrifice and efforts. What beautiful sentences out of Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. Not only for parenting and the motherhood and the mother's rights, but for the other rights which is on your shoulder. Refer to this book. Just take a look at it. How beautifully Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, more than 1,000 years ago, enumerates different rights that must be observed by a Muslim. Rights of parents, rights of neighbors, rights of environment, rights of animals, even over there. A good mother places the needs of the child, both physical and emotional needs, first. This is an important point to keep in mind, especially in these modern times. Women today are deluded by society into making their own careers and jobs more important than their homes. The home will always remain a woman's most valuable work, and that may require all types of sacrifices. It is not really a sacrifice, but it is investment which will recap or re-app great dividends. Tips for Muslim mothers. Read Quran in front of children. If you want your child to be a good and practicing Muslim, be a practicing Muslim on his or her own front. Quran recitation is crucial for a Muslim mother to understand deen or religion. If you make a constant habit of reciting the Quran and your child observes it, there is no chance that he or she wouldn't show interest in what you are reading. But be mindful, habits are developed at early ages, so even your toddler doesn't get what you are reciting, but it's getting imprinted in his or her memory for afterward implementation. Even today's psychology, even today's science says that when a mother is pregnant with a child, recitation of the Quran will have its own positive effect on tranquility of the embryo in the womb of the mother. Can you believe that? How much recitation of the Holy Quran can make your child tranquil, calm down, and have a kind of peaceful lifestyle? This is really beautiful. That's it. This is how beautiful the recitation of the Holy Quran is, how it's affecting your children. So as a mother, even as a father, try to recite the Holy Quran in the house so that your children recite the Quran in a good way. If you do it with good tajweed, if you do it with good sound, you know, with voice quality, if you listen also to beautiful recitations, I have a good suggestion for you. Brother Parhizgar is one of them. Just play it in the house instead of these, you know, trash music every day in the house, pieces of tracks over here, the movies, miniserials. Just listen to the Holy Quran, recitation of the Holy Quran. Enjoy it, and your child will enjoy it. And your child will see that the parents are reciting the Holy Quran, so gradually they will learn how to recite the Holy Quran.
expecting in this world is the second point that we want to talk about. A mother commands great respect from her family, the same way that Lady Fatima salamallahu alayha was respected by her dad first, and second by her husband, and then by her children. She is to be obeyed and venerated. I mean, right after the arrival or the birth of Lady Fatima salamallahu alayha, we understood that how greatly Islam impacted the role of mother and wanted to change the kind of view that existed with regard to the women and or the girls in general. So everything got revolutionized, and Islam comes to give respect to ladies, to women, to mothers first. While before Islam or pre-Islamic era, such a thing did not exist. I mean, even the stories have been heard by all that girls have been killed at early ages or have been buried while alive. So we see that Islam wants us to respect ladies.
Thank you very much for being with us with today's special about motherhood and about parenting. We hope you enjoyed today's episode with me, Atta, the host of this program. For more information, don't forget to visit our website, iranradio.ir. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Till another episode, we leave you our last care. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Rabbi, Muhammad Nabi, Ali Imami. لا فتى إلا علي علي إمامي علي إمامي علي إمامي
لا إله إلا الله الله ربي
محمد نبي علي إمامي
لا فتى إلا علي علي إمامي علي إمامي علي
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Professor Mearsham, welcome here, my dear friend. Before we talk about can Europe save Ukraine, I just finished reading a great piece that you wrote. It may have been derived from a speech that you gave on the bleak future that Europe has. But before we get there, our dear friend and colleague Alistair Crook is reporting that Israeli press is reporting that Prime Minister Netanyahu is threatening Israeli President Herzog over the issue of the pardon, and contrary to Israeli law, is unwilling to admit guilt and unwilling to leave public office. I'm going to guess that you're not surprised by any of this.
Hardly at all. I mean, Netanyahu is someone who is deeply committed to remaining in office for as long as he possibly can. And as we've talked about on the show, he's done a brilliant job at prolonging his tenure as prime minister, given the fact that he was the prime minister on October 7th when Israel was caught by surprise and suffered that devastating defeat that day, and Furthermore, given that he has been under indictment and has been in court for well over a year now, the fact that he survived is quite remarkable. He has no intention of leaving office. So he'll cut a deal, but it's only if it's a deal that leaves him in office and basically leaves him unscathed.
I'm going to guess that this doesn't surprise you either. The Financial Times is reporting that Arab leaders have told President Trump that they will not accept Tony Blair on the so-called Trump Peace Board, and they absolutely reject him. I'm trying to say this with a straight face as the governor general. I can't imagine that. He's going to live in Gaza anyway. They're going to reject him as the governor general of Gaza.
No, it's very interesting. This Haaretz has a big piece today that says in the headline that Tony Blair has been visiting Netanyahu since October 7th on a frequent basis.
I saw that.
Yeah. So, I mean, this guy is in bed with the Israelis. The idea that he's going to be the one who administers Gaza. I mean, when you think about what's going on with regard to Gaza, it's really quite amazing. The two principal negotiators for the United States are Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, who are dyed-in-the-wool Zionists. They should not be negotiating for the United States with regard to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And then you throw in Tony Blair, who's not much different than Kushner, and Witkoff. This looks like a colonial enterprise, what Trump is trying to do in Gaza. There's no self-determination whatsoever for the Palestinians in this deal that he's concocted for Gaza. There's no political horizon. There's no self-determination. Basically, he's going to have a bunch of Europeans running it, and he's going to be nominally in charge, he meaning Trump. And then they're going to bring in some Arab and Islamic countries to police the place. This is the idea. This is a non-starter. It's just not going to work. And by the way, just to take this a step further, a number of countries, Pakistan, Indonesia, for example, who have been not mentioned as possible countries that would put peacekeeping forces in Gaza, have said they will not go into Gaza until Hamas is disarmed. And Hamas, of course, is not going to disarm. They'd be crazy to disarm because there is no hope of a political endgame for the Palestinians. There's no self-determination here. If Hamas disarmed, they'd leave themselves wide open to the IDF.
Can Netanyahu claim with a straight face? I suppose we could stop right there and I could just fill in the blank. Anybody could fill in the blank. Can he claim with a straight face that his government is abiding by the Witkoff-Kushner-Trump so-called ceasefire?
Not with a straight face. I mean, if you look at what's happening in Lebanon, if you look at what's happening in Gaza, there's abundant evidence, a superabundant of evidence, that the Israelis are not abiding by the ceasefire. They violated on a consistent basis in Lebanon, and they violated on a consistent basis in Gaza. And what does the United States do in these cases? It stands idly by and allows the Israelis to do whatever they want. We continue to fund them, and we continue to give them equipment and support them diplomatically if they ever get into any trouble.
Just like the Congress of the United States sits idly by and lets the president do whatever he wants, even when he's murdering people on the high seas in the Caribbean Ocean, 1,500 miles from the United States.
That's true. But at least the Congress is beginning to get cold feet. They're beginning to get nervous.
Right.
You don't see any of that in terms of how Trump deals with the Israelis or how Congress deals with the Israelis. And that's basically because, as I've said on numerous occasions, the lobby owns Trump and the lobby owns Congress.
Right, right, right. I mean, is there any feasible way to stop these killings, these criminal acts on the Caribbean, other than perhaps scaring Congress into thinking its members will not be reelected once the public sees the murders on film?
That's possible. I'd say the likelihood of that happening is in the range of 5 to 10%.
Wow.
I mean, the truth is, if Congress decided to take the bull by the horns and get tough with Trump, I think he'd just ignore them.
Here's Senator Rand Paul, actually earlier today on this. Chris, cut number 10.
We've been doing this for 30 years. When the Coast Guard picks up boats off of Venezuela, which we have done historically, about one in four of the boats, maybe one in five, don't have drugs. So we make mistakes. Are we willing to execute people with a 20% error rate? This is an insane policy. It's inconsistent. It's not war, and it's not the way we've ever done this. Think about it. If we can blow up a boat in the ocean that is at war with us because of the drugs, what about when they get to Miami and they put it in a truck, and the truck's going from Miami to Orlando? Can you shoot a grenade launcher at the truck? No, we arrest people because sometimes we're wrong. You know, the make and the model of the truck is this, and oh, we made a mistake. That was somebody on vacation. We don't blow up people without first arresting them. And this is the way it's been done on the high seas for 100 years or more. And what we're doing now is just plain wrong.
It's a classic, constitutionally faithful clarion cry for something as simple and basic as due process.
I agree. It's hard to disagree with anything that Senator Paul said. I would also note that I think that it's very important that people pay attention to the rule of law, both domestically and internationally. I mean, we have laws for good reason. And I understand that sometimes countries have to violate the law because it's in their security, it's in their national interest. It makes sense from a security point of view. But you want to minimize the number of times you do that and otherwise follow the law as much as possible. And the same thing is true at the domestic level. And in this country, with regard to our leadership, and I think it was true with the Biden administration as well, paying attention to the law was just not that important. We thought we could do pretty much whatever we wanted to do. And the only difference between the Biden administration and the Trump administration at the international level is that the Biden administration trumpeted the virtues of the international legal system, the rule of law internationally, while in practice they were stomping all over it. The Trump administration, at least, is consistent. They're constantly railing against the rules-based order or international law, while at the same time traipsing all over it.
Well, see if you can figure out what the president meant here, because first he says we will release the second tape, the tape showing the survivors clinging onto chunks of wood for 45 minutes before they were murdered. And then he said, I never said I'd release the tape, and then he said he wasn't sure what he said. This, see if you can figure it out, what he means, number 11.
Mr. President, you released video of that first boat strike on September 2nd, but not the second video. Will you release video of that strike so that the American people can see for themselves what happened?
I don't know what they have, but whatever they have, we'd certainly release, no problem.
Mr. President, you said you would have no problem with releasing the full video of that strike on September 2nd off the coast of Venezuela.
Secretary Hegseth now says...
You said that. I didn't say that. This is ABC fake news.
You said that you would have no problem releasing the full bit. Okay, well, Secretary Hegseth... No,
whatever Hegseth wants to do is okay with
me. He now says it's under review. Are you ordering the secretary to release that full video?
Whatever he decides is okay with me.
Are you committed to releasing the full video?
Didn't I just tell you that?
You said that it was up to Secretary Hegseth.
You're the most obnoxious reporter in the whole place. Let me just tell you, you are an obnoxious, a terrible reporter.
This is really ridiculous coming from the President of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, what can you say at this point?
All right, let's transition. When the Kremlin agreed to disband the Warsaw Pact, why did the United States stay in NATO?
We stayed in NATO because we understood that we served as a pacifier in Europe, or at least in the western half of Europe. As long as NATO was intact, that meant the United States was there, and it had its security umbrella over the West Europeans. Now, it's very important to understand that when the Soviets disbanded the Warsaw Pact, they were nevertheless content to leave NATO intact. they were content to allow the United States to remain in Europe because the Soviets understood that we did act as a pacifier. And this is especially relevant with regard to West Germany, which was in the process of becoming Germany. Because you remember at the end of the Cold War, Germany was reunified. So the German reunification caused worries all across Europe. And people thought that the best way to deal with that potential problem was to keep NATO intact, which meant keep the Americans in Europe. We bought that argument, the Europeans bought that argument, and the Soviets and later the Russians bought that argument. So there's no problem there. Where does the problem come? It comes with NATO expansion.
Right.
You well know, Judge, we told the Soviets that we would not expand NATO, that it would not be expanded eastward. And then the Clinton administration came along and they decided in 1994 that NATO would be expanded. And that is the principal source of the problem today. Had we not expanded NATO, and certainly if we had not expanded NATO or tried to expand NATO into Ukraine, Europe, I believe, would be peaceful today.
Instead, you have argued, this is a great piece, it's at the American Conservative, it probably appears elsewhere. Did you give it as a speech or did you write it as an editorial?
No, I gave it as a speech before the European Parliament.
Okay, because I could hear your voice and enjoy, actually rejoice in some of your favorite figures of speech. And you argued so powerfully that Europe's future is bleak. Why do you say that?
Well, it's very bleak for two reasons. One is there's not going to be a happy ending to the Ukraine war. The Russians are going to win an ugly victory. Ukraine is going to be destroyed. And very importantly, relations between Russia on one side and Ukraine and Europe on the other side are going to be poisonous. And they're going to be dangerous because there's always a possibility, given all the flashpoints that exist in Eastern Europe, their war will break out again. So once the war ends, once the shooting stops and you get some sort of armistice or frozen conflict, the potential for conflict, armed conflict, is still going to be there. And you want to remember you're operating in an environment where there are poisonous relations. The other point, and this is of great importance, is that the United States is pivoting to Asia in a major way. You see this in the new national security strategy that the Trump administration has just put out. We view China as our principal concern. And there's a great deal of emphasis in the administration, and especially with Trump himself, in focusing on East Asia and leaving the Europeans to defend for themselves. So what I'm saying here, Judge, is that if we pivot to East Asia, which I think is likely, the end result is that NATO will definitely collapse, or it certainly will be a shell of its former self. And the end result is that the Europeans will be on their own to provide for their own security. And the Europeans live in fear of that possibility. So I think when you put all these things together, it's a very bleak future for Europe.
So the Sun of London, the tabloid, reports just a few minutes ago that a British soldier was killed in Ukraine. Now, Colonel McGregor informs that many British special forces and MI6 have been killed, but none of it's been revealed. This time they revealed it because it happened in some sort of a training accident and the press was there and the guy was in uniform. Is this going to affect the Kremlin thinking at all? That a British soldier in uniform was killed in Ukraine?
No, I don't think they're going to care at all for two reasons. One, I'm sure they already know that there are British soldiers in Ukraine. Not many of them, but some of them. The fact is the Russians are principally concerned with waging the war on the battlefield, and whether there are 10 British soldiers, 100 British soldiers, or even 1,000 British soldiers just doesn't matter very much. And more importantly, the British are not going to put in 1,000 soldiers. They're not going to directly engage in the fight in any meaningful way. So this just doesn't matter very much.
If you had been a fly on the wall at 10 Downing Street yesterday when Volodymyr Zelensky showed up and was greeted by Sir Keir Starmer, President Emmanuel Macron, and Chancellor Merz, what do you think you would have heard? What could they possibly say to him? They can't raise taxes. They can't borrow money. Belgium won't let them steal the money from the Belgian banks. What can they do for him?
Well, unless they can steal that money, those frozen Russian assets from Euroclear, there's hardly anything they can do. Ukraine is certainly doomed if that proves to be the case. So I think what they probably told Zelensky at this point in time is to hold the line, and they would do everything they can to steal that money and make sure that Ukraine gets the $100+ billion that it desperately needs so they can continue the war. I mean, there's no question that the Europeans, much like the Ukrainians, are profoundly committed to keeping this war going. They obviously think that there's some chance that the Russians will collapse before Ukraine collapses, and that we will emerge, we meaning the West, and the Ukrainians will emerge victorious. I think this is tilting at windmills, but it's quite clear that the Europeans seem to believe that.
President Trump, in another one of his rants, we don't have it on tape, apparently said he doesn't like the Europeans, he doesn't trust them, and he's thinking of walking away from Ukraine. Now, he said that before, so I don't know that we can put much credence in it. And we just watched that clip where he said, yeah, release the tape, and 5 hours later denied that he had said it. So these sort of wild, almost ridiculous, at times hilarious interactions with the press and in the Oval Office, I don't think they can really be fairly used as a window into his thinking.
Well, one way of thinking about what's going on, which ties this discussion of Trump to the previous question about the three European leaders and Zelensky, is that everybody now understands that Ukraine is going to lose. And the question is, who's going to get the blame? Who's going to bear the responsibility for the loss? And one could argue that Trump will not simply walk away from Ukraine, because that will then allow the Ukrainians, and especially the Europeans, to blame him for the collapse of Ukraine. So the smart thing for Trump to do in this story is to say, this is a European responsibility, and I will do everything I can to help the Europeans keep the Ukrainians afloat. So that's the Trump perspective. From the European side of the equation, there, I think they want to fight and fight and fight, fight to the last Ukrainian. So they cannot be accused of having bailed out on Ukraine, and can actually make the argument that it's Trump who's responsible for Ukraine's collapse. So what I'm saying to you here is, I have to believe, given what's happening on the battlefield, that the Europeans, and certainly Donald Trump, understand that Ukraine is doomed, that they're going to lose this war, and there's no way of turning the tide. And therefore, the question is a blame game, or the question is, who gets the blame? You're involved.
Right. And Trump is a master at deflecting blame.
Oh, he's brilliant at that. And the Europeans are very good at that as well.
Mm.
Because you want to understand that this is going to be a catastrophic defeat. This is not a minor defeat. This is not like losing in Afghanistan, right? This is a major war where Europe and the United States, or NATO more generally, was on one side, and the Russians were on the other.
Well, you know who he'll blame it on. He'll blame it on Biden, and Biden does bear a lot of blame, but he does, Trump as well, for arming the Ukrainians before Biden was in office, and for continuing to arm them after he came to office the second time. Here is this statement, a bizarre statement he made, as if that's news, on Saturday, claiming that President Zelensky hasn't even, I don't know how he could know this, hasn't even read the so-called 28-point proposal. There's a little bit more in there. We'll let you see it and hear it now. Chris, number six.
What's your next step in Russia-Ukraine talks after last week's negotiations?
So we've been speaking to President Putin, and we've been speaking to Ukrainian leaders, including Zelensky, President Zelensky. And I have to say that I'm a little bit disappointed that President Zelensky hasn't yet read the proposal. That was as of a few hours ago. His people love it, but he hasn't. Russia's fine with it. Russia's, you know, Russia, I guess, would rather have the whole country when you think of it. But Russia is, I believe, fine with it. But I'm not sure that Zelensky's fine with it. His people love it, but he hasn't read it.
It's really crazy. His people don't love it. Russia's not fine with it. How could he know whether or not it's been read? That was, by the way, Sunday evening. I misspoke when I said Saturday.
The Russians don't accept this 28-point plan. The Ukrainian people, and I assume by that he means all of Zelensky's advisors, all the key national security establishment figures in Ukraine, they don't accept this plan for one second.
Right.
Zelensky himself, I can't believe he hasn't read it. I'm sure he has, but he surely knows what's in it if he hasn't read it, and he completely rejects it. This is what he said yesterday when he talked to the press after meeting with the three European leaders. He doesn't accept the deal. Nobody accepts the deal. That's the problem. There's no deal to be had here.